Good morning. For 6 weeks now, the United States has been at war, and we have brought you regular reports on events on many fronts. Again this morning, we present a roundup of foreign capitals for on-the-spot news. And first, we switch to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Fires were blazing in the Singapore oil depot today after Japanese planes had bombed the naval base area. It's officially said that the flames were being brought under control. Two Japanese aircraft were destroyed and others damaged. Early today, RAF planes bombed Japanese troop concentrations, supplies, and ammunition. The RAF worked on the Gemas Railroad. Fighting is going on east of Gemas, which is about 130 miles north of Singapore. Yesterday's raid casualties in Singapore are now stated to have been 130 killed and 100 injured. Between 800 and 1,000 Japanese are reported to have been killed in their first clash with the Australians. British bombers last night raided Bremen, Emden, and other points in northwest Germany. Three British planes are missing. Cairo today reported that a couple of Italian generals were captured with the senior German officer in hellfire. Dispatches reaching London from the Western Desert seem to indicate the campaign is slowing down. Rommel still seems to be in a fairly strong position and playing a waiting defensive game until he can get reinforcements. The problem of the British commanders is whether to drive Rommel back and take Tripoli or to dig in and turn the whole campaign into a defensive one. Reports indicate the lengthening lines of communications may be causing the British commanders some worry. London commentators declare the failure to capture Tripoli may decide the whole policy of French North Africa, and the Sunday Express says, "Twice Providence has given us the chance, and twice we have failed to grasp it." Scrutator in the Sunday Times points out that while he holds Tripoli, Rommel can get reinforcements in 24 hours, while every man and tank of the British reinforcements must go around the Cape of Good Hope. London Sunday papers give their headlines to two events, the return of Mr. Churchill to England and the mysterious death of Field Marshal von Reichenau. Mr. Churchill presided over a special cabinet meeting last night, a few hours after he arrived in London. His flight from Bermuda to Plymouth is being described as one of the most daring of the war, and the British are pleased at the thought of German planes and U-boats searching for him in vain. One paper has a cartoon of an angry Hitler inspecting a shame-faced group of Luftwaffe men and saying, "So you didn't even see one teeny-weeny little English flying boat." Von Reichenau's death is causing a lot of speculation, and commentators draw attention to the fact that the official German news expressed no regret and failed to give the usual appreciation or biographical sketch. It's generally thought that he was done away with in the von Fritsch manner. Moscow reports of a purge in the German high command are printed here. Whether Hitler liquidated his general because of failure in Russia, or whether the high command did the job because they feared his pro-Nazi leanings, is something nobody in London knows. But they talk about it anyway. Authoritative quarters don't attach any great importance to his death, but naturally they're pleased at having one less German general to cope with. British air experts are speculating these days on the types of aircraft America will concentrate on in her great plane production drive. The Aeroplane, the authoritative British aircraft magazine, has pointed out that an output of 60,000 American planes this year means that about 720,000 new ground crews, clerical staffs, and so forth will be needed by the nations who operate those planes. 45,000 new combat types in 1942 means that about 7,900 will be operational at any moment, forming approximately 315 squadrons. This means new aerodromes, ground defenses, guns, and equipment. British air experts believe the United States will probably concentrate on types like the Fortress, the Liberator, and the fast day bomber, the Martin Marauder. It's being generally emphasized that the Allies' greatest need is for fighters. And British writers are saying that the only really modern American fighter that can compare with the British Typhoon or can beat the latest Spitfire is the Republic Thunderbolt. Experienced British fighter pilots who've flown it in America are said to be enthusiastic about it. Some of the flyers I've talked with here believe the tremendous expansion of the American Air Forces will mean that training programs have to be clipped and streamlined. The British pilots who fought the Battle of France and the Battle of Britain were probably more carefully trained than any other flyers in the world. They beat the Luftwaffe on sheer ability, not equipment. But the need for quick expansion of the RAF meant that training shortcuts had to be introduced, and the British have proved the shortcuts could be made successfully. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Back in New York, we have a dispatch from Atlantic City, New Jersey. The fire is under control this morning on the freighter Santa Elisa, which collided with the United Fruit Company freighter San Jose last night off the New Jersey coast. But the 3,300-ton San Jose is on the bottom. She sank almost immediately after the collision. The Coast Guard says 53 survivors have been picked up, all crewmen and officers of the sunken ship. Just how many men are missing has not yet been determined. 18 crew members of the other ship, the Santa Elisa, have been removed. But there is no indication that the freighter, which is owned by the Grace Line, is being abandoned. It caught fire after the collision. News of the Pacific Theater is next on our roundup today. And for this, we take you now to the newsroom in San Francisco.
And we turn across the distant reaches of the Pacific to the powerful Dutch transmitter in the Netherlands East Indies. Go ahead, Batavia.
This is Sidney Albright, speaking in Batavia. The time is 9:36 Sunday evening. On January 16th, after the bombardment at midday, which was already mentioned in a preceding communique, Medan was again attacked by 13 Japanese bombers, which dropped 8 bombs around the golf club building. There were no casualties and no damage was caused, states today's communique of the Netherlands Indies Fighting Forces. The communique also tells of an attack yesterday morning by 7 Japanese bombers on an airdrome in Middle Sumatra. Some damage was inflicted, and although further details are awaited, it is known that a few civilians were killed and approximately 30 were wounded. The raids on Ambon are becoming more frequent. There were several alarms yesterday. One attack was made by 4 fighters, but there were no casualties, and there was very little damage. From reliable reports, it appears that during the repeated enemy air raids on airports and villages in the outer provinces, the morale of the Indies troops has been excellent. In the heavy raid on the Medan airdrome, one soldier distinguished himself by remaining on guard on top of a blazing building until he was ordered down by a superior officer. Many similar stories reached Batavia describing the bravery of the native troops. One high official said, "Apparently, the Indonesian soldiers are fearless, or else they have supreme confidence in their ability to defend their homeland." Today's newspapers explain to what extent private enterprises have been compelled to change their policy as a result of war circumstances. About 77% of all European personnel were mobilized into military and civilian services. The remaining 23% have had to do all the work, which so far has not reduced in volume. It is logical that this drastic changeover cannot be effected on short notice. Gradually, the situation is adjusting itself, and the strain will further decrease because of restrictions on the importation of luxury articles due to limitation of shipping space. The export trade is also falling off because of priority given to shipments of important materials required by the Allies. Some of the Indonesian papers show considerable surprise at the statement made by Colonel Knox that Hitler is public enemy number one. The Indonesians can only see Japan in this role, and they are inclined to interpret Mr. Knox's statement as an indication that America does not intend to apply its full strength against Japanese aggression. A joint committee has been formed for the purpose of coordinating all organizations aiding in the Netherlands Indies war effort. This plan seems particularly desirable for the purpose of centralizing appeals to the public to make voluntary contributions or assistance to the Indies forces, as well as the Allied forces serving in this archipelago. Extensive plans are being made for the entertainment and general welfare of the troops. Allied canteens have been established where English-speaking servicemen may enjoy an evening with their English-speaking friends. Theaters have joined in the movement by giving reductions to men in uniform. There has been a run on the bookstores for English dictionaries and instruction books to learn the English language in 10 easy lessons. Batavia had two air raid alarms in the night of Friday, Saturday, but they did not bother me in the least. It was the first time during an alert that I have felt entirely at ease. I was with two generals. I now return you to San Francisco.
Now back to the newsroom in New York.
For our final on-the-scene report, we turn to Morgan Beatty, who speaks from the newsroom in Washington.
Overnight developments in the Battle of the Pacific indicate the struggle in the Far East has reached the stage where it can be called a war of friction. That is, the Japanese are plunging forward, reckless of cost, and the Allies are responding with maneuvers designed to wear down the enemy. The military word for it is attrition, but friction better describes the operation. The clues come from all the Pacific War theaters, from Batavia, where Sidney Albright has reported the details to you. His report further indicates that the Japanese may have air superiority in that region. In the Singapore zone, as you've heard from John McVane in London, the Japanese Air Force is attacking defending lines north of Singapore and the naval base itself. In the Philippines, General MacArthur is absorbing the shock of superior Japanese force and firepower, and with remarkable courage and skill. But the overnight naval communique issued here in Washington best illustrates our long-range strategy of friction. It throws the American plan into bold relief. One of our naval submarines has destroyed three Japanese steamers practically under the muzzles of the Mikado's guns off the Bay of Tokyo. The immediate purpose of this attack was threefold. First, we destroyed supplies obviously intended for one of Japan's distant outposts in the Singapore zone. Three steamers can carry a lot of war material. Second, the Navy shows the world that neither the Japanese, nor the Germans, nor our own gallant allies, the Royal Navy, has anything on Uncle Sam in the way of courage or daring. And we let the Japanese know, third, that we can pull a sneak attack even after war is declared. We do not resort to treachery. But these objectives alone do not warrant our Naval High Command's decision to send a submarine to Tokyo. But long-range strategy in the War of Friction removes this deed from the purely heroic and courageous and places it in the category of plain common sense. For the place to strike the enemy's supply lines is right under the enemy's guns. There the lines gather, and there the pickings are fatter. The record to date in the War of Friction is impressive. Already the Navy has officially announced the destruction of 24 Japanese ships, and the Army has destroyed probably 10 more. Add the three of last night, and you have 30. That's 24 and 10 is 34, and 3 is 37. Add this to the nearly 20 Japanese vessels sunk by Dutch submarines and planes, and we begin to see what this kind of war is doing. The Japanese cannot replace these vessels overnight. Their shipyards are limited. The 65 building ways they have cannot launch vessels as fast as we are destroying them. But that does not mean we can win the war purely by wearing down the Japanese. It does mean we can use and are using our forces to the best possible advantage while we ready ourselves for the offensive. In Washington, that getting ready process is going ahead by leaps and bounds. Take shipping. The government has just signed contracts for 632 more merchant ships to be delivered before the end of 1943. The Maritime Commission is trying to conform to the President's demand for 8,000 tons by the end of this year, or 8 million tons by the end of this year, and 10 million tons next year. Incidentally, official Washington has been taken completely by surprise on the labor front. The John L. Lewis letter proposing peace to the AFL was not expected in government circles, but the government is deeply interested nevertheless. There's a tendency in well-informed quarters to believe the letter was written only after Lewis and AFL leaders had talked over the prospects for peace and found them good. Significant is the absence of Phil Murray from Washington. It's not at all certain just what Lewis had in mind here, but some observers point out that the AFL has never been a political organization, but the CIO has. That may be significant. That's all for now.
And that's the news this Sunday morning in England, Java, and the United States. Reporters heard on this program were John McVane from London, Sidney Albright from Batavia, and Morgan Beatty from Washington. For latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.